With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Here he is with the corner. The Brazilian. Going in, there's a fearful crack of heads there.
It was sickening to watch, uncomfortable, and the kind of scene that leaves you with no words, just hope for the best.
It was a hefty collision. It really was, wasn't it?
Yeah, with real determination.
Raul Jimenez and David Luiz aerially collided at an Arsenal corner. The Wolves forward lay motionless for minutes. He was given oxygen, he was stretchered off. He was taken to a London hospital where he underwent surgery on a fractured skull.
It's serious, it was a big impact, but he's aware and he's with Dr. Matt Perry.
A fractured skull. Luiz passed the current concussion protocol. His head was bandaged and he returned to action. Blood seeped through his dressings and he was unsettled heading the ball. The defender had to be removed, but he shouldn't have even been allowed to continue.
Football needs to get real, it needs to wake up, it needs to get serious. Not next year, not next month, not next week, now.
Football is still in the last century when it comes to dealing with head trauma. According to Dr. Willie Stewart, the neuropathologist who proved the game's link with dementia.
This problem is bigger in football than it is in rugby, than it is in American football, possibly than it even is in boxing.
In January 2017, Ryan Mason, then playing for Hull City, received 8 minutes of treatment on the pitch at Stamford Bridge after a clash of heads with Chelsea defender Gary Cahill.
Gary Cahill trying to attack it. Clash of heads and Niels Wahlberg, as you saw straight away, calling for the medical men.
He was given oxygen. He was carried off on a stretcher. He had surgery at St. Mary's Hospital in London for a fractured skull, which had to have 14 metal plates inserted, with 28 screws holding them in place, along with 45 staples. He was forced to retire in February 2018, at the age of 26, but feels lucky to be alive.
I was almost 100% sure that I'd get back on the football pitch, it was just a matter of when, but I had some scans and some issues showed up with the brain that wasn't possible, you know. I'd be putting my health, my life at risk if I was to step onto a football pitch.
From Mason's injury to the one Jimenez suffered, nothing has changed. Football is dragging its feet when it comes to head collisions and adequately dealing with it. On this episode of Between the Lines, we unpack how dangerous that is and why the proposal on the table, a permanent concussion sub, is not going to help in any way. We look at what the game can do to improve its protocols, making it safer for players. Our guests are Dr. Willie Stewart, whose research found that former footballers were 3.5 times more likely to die of dementia. Peter McCabe, chief executive of Headway, the Brain Injury Association. Ryan Mason and Phil Quinlan, who suffered life-changing head trauma at 15 on a football pitch that left him paralyzed. The point to kick off at is with the man who is the leading light in detailing football's link to degenerative brain diseases. Dr. Willie Stewart is a consultant pathologist in Glasgow who has spent over 20 years researching this subject. Dr. Willie, I want to get stuck into how this all came about, how you started being involved in uncovering this link with football and brain injuries leading to dementia.
Yeah, well, I'm fortunate that I trained in neuropathology in Glasgow. And Glasgow, at the time I was training back in the early 2000s, was an international centre of excellence in understanding brain injury, right from patients coming through the casualty doors to our service looking at the brain pathology. And they'd been in that position for several decades, really since the late 60s. So I entered this environment where research and brain injury was just part of what we did. And I started working on this. And one of the things I noticed was that there were stories of people with brain injury, head injury, not just boxers, but people who'd been hit by cars, and the risk of dementia was thought to be higher. I mean, I looked at the material down the microscope as a project to try and understand whether this might be something we could see down a microscope. I could see that people who, in those days, the material I was looking at was people who had sustained a single moderate or severe brain injury and died some decades or years later. And lo and behold, they seemed to have a pathology there which looked like we saw in other dementias more than they should do. And that made me think, well, there's something in this. Now, about the same time, Bennett Amalu was publishing his paper on the first American football case of what we now call CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, but was previously known as dementia pugilistica. So I'm sitting looking at people who've been hit by a car or assaulted and survived. Bennett was publishing a paper on the effects of brain injury in American football. And there's this long history of knowing the problems with boxing. So putting all that together made me start to think, well, if we can see it in boxers, we can see it in American footballers, we can see it in people who've had car accidents, then why shouldn't we be able to see it in people who, for instance, played rugby or played football, the kind of sports that we're more familiar with? And that's really what began the research that continues now.
And you were the first person to identify CTE in a UK footballer in 2014. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so at the time this was all beginning to, you know, people were beginning to pay more attention to it. So you know, I a lot of my work is with colleagues in America, and this subject has been something that has been discussed and researched for over 15 years now. And but it was only in the last decade or so that in the UK and outside Europe, outside the US, people have begun to pay more attention to it. So at the time, early in the last decade, the attention was beginning to turn to UK sports like football and rugby and the possible link there to late pathologies. I was obviously aware of Jeff Astle and Jeff Astle's case. And a good friend and colleague of mine had originally looked at his brain back in early 2000s. And I got contacted by the family through a newspaper reporter connection to ask if I would kindly review his Jeff's material from that original diagnosis, just to see whether actually the pathology described then as severe pathology and possibly linked to head injury might have been the CTE. And so one of the things that we have in pathology is the ability to go back and look again. So I contacted my friend, asked if he would mind sharing the material with me. That material was sent to our lab. We did some extra work on it and confirmed that actually the pathology in Jeff's brain, although at the time the diagnosis was thought to be Alzheimer's disease, the actual pathology was this chronic traumatic encephalopathy pathology. So confirming that Jeff actually unfortunately passed away of CTE.
Can you explain the study itself to us and how it took shape? Because the evidence has been there for a while.
Yeah. And I think the important thing is, though, that we sort of knew about teams like 1966 back at, you know, the time that we were first discussing Jeff Astle's case, or so the second time we're discussing Jeff Astle's case in CTE, because Dawn as a kind of focal point for many of the families to get in touch and share their experiences could bring forward, you know, dozens literally of cases of former footballers with dementia. And in those dozens, there were also teams where four or five or sometimes six of the team had dementia. dementia. And even then, you know, the 1966, you know, going back to the middle of last decade, the 1966 team was known to have a number of players with dementia. But although we could see these teams with large numbers, and we knew there were families getting in touch, and I was receiving brains from former footballers with dementia, none of this proved that there was necessarily any more dementia in footballers than you'd expect. You know, it may just be that these are high-profile individuals, and so we're more aware of them. So what we had to do was design a study that actually looked at it at what we call, you know, the population level, the epidemiological level, where we actually look at all footballers and figure out how many footballers there are there with dementia problems, and compare that to a population of people from the population who didn't play football but were close to them as we could make them. So this is what we did. So we took this observation that there seemed to be a lot of footballers with dementia, and we took it into a population level study where we studied 8,000 former footballers and compared them to 23,000 people in the population who were born in the same year, lived in much the same area. So as close as we could make them were our footballers, and that's where we uncovered this risk that it wasn't just that, you know, we were seeing more teams and more footballers. There was actually a big problem with dementia in football. So, as you say, 3.5 times higher risk of death of degenerative brain disease, doubling of Parkinson's, 4-fold increase in motor neuron disease, 5-fold increase in Alzheimer's disease. Quite a problem.
That is alarming to hear. If the science on the matter isn't startling enough, personal experiences of suffering severe head trauma on the pitch should leave you in no doubt as to how serious it can be. Life-threatening, to be exact. And why football has to accept this and do better to mitigate against it. Ryan Mason rewinds to January 2017, when a few seconds entirely reshaped his life and left it hanging in the balance.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a strange moment, because you never expect anything like that to happen on a football pitch. Unfortunately, I was on the receiving end of a late challenge, and subsequently had some serious and some complications with my brain that unfortunately ended my career. I would say a lot has changed since then on the football pitch, but it actually hasn't, which is probably why I'm so passionate about talking now, because obviously Raul has suffered a similar incident. And firstly, I hope he's okay. I hope his family and everyone around him are okay. But it brings back memories for me and my family, which aren't pleasant, because we suffered a lot. We went through a lot together. And you never really expect something like that to happen on a football pitch. There's obviously a lot of pain. The head, the brain, is the most complex part of the body. It's the most vulnerable, and if you damage it, it could be the most fatal as well. And you obviously have so much pain, of course, but then there's so much that goes on in the brain that you can't record, you can't tell if it's okay or what the real damage is. So I'm sure for Raul and his family, there's a lot of worry. Obviously, I've not had a great deal of information of his current situation, but the initial days and the initial weeks, there's so many unanswered questions, because you just don't know. When the brain takes a whack like that, there's so many complications that you can get. And it's almost a little bit of a waiting game to see how you recover and how your body gets back to a normal state, to be honest. So much worry, probably more so from the family, because my situation, I was so heavily dosed on drugs, and I was in hospital for a while. I was at home sleeping so much. So there's so many questions that you don't know what the answer is to. It's impossible to know so early on. So I think that's probably one of the worst things, aside from the fact you've had an operation on your head, on your skull, potentially on his brain, like me. And that's never a nice thought, because like I said before, the brain is so complex. And when you have an injury like that that requires surgery, it's worrying.
Now, you had 14 metal plates in your skull, 28 screws holding them in place, 45 staples a 6-inch scar across your head. It you couldn't open your jaw, your mouth properly. And it was only until 10 weeks after the operation that you could do that properly. That's all. It's like, it's staggering to think about all that. It's hard to actually comprehend.
Yeah. I mean, I could have a list of so many things that actually affected me for so long afterwards. Sometimes I forget. I've got it all wrote down, but yeah, I couldn't look at light. I was sleeping for like 20 hours a day. I couldn't really hold a conversation. Like I say, when the brain gets an injury, the body almost just instinctively responds, and it almost just shuts everything else down, because the main focus is on making sure the brain's okay, because it's the fundamental to how we live as humans. And the body invests so much energy into recovery. So your normal things, like for me, I couldn't speak two sentences, because it just seemed like so much effort, so much energy. I was sleeping all the time. I couldn't really walk. There were so many of these problems that I had to live with, but then also my family and my people, my little circle close to me, had to live with as well, which makes it very difficult. It makes it very difficult because they almost live through the trauma with you. So Raul and his family are sure they're going through something very similar, where it can affect people. It can take its toll. You know, the stress, the worry, the uncertainty of not knowing the extent of the recovery and what the real damage is at this stage. So I definitely feel for Raul and his family, because I've been through something probably very similar.
Phil Quinlan was a promising young footballer in Ireland when in 1989, age 15, he was involved in a collision that would leave him in a coma. After the contact, he was asked a few questions and encouraged to play on. This is his story, which may have happened a long time ago, but it shows that football hasn't really progressed too much in terms of head injuries.
Started football officially, organized football at 14 years of age, played for a year, I'd say, and then that's when the injury occurred. On the morning of the match, it was very, very foggy in my hometown, and we had to drive about 4 miles outside of the town to get to the pitch, and the fog was so bad we couldn't even see the pitch from where the bus stopped, and we walked across two fields to get to the pitch, and you couldn't see more than 10 meters in front of you. And I suppose about half an hour into the game, I was playing on the left wing. Half an hour into the game, I went up for a header and I felt a glancing blow from the centre half on the other team. And we both went down. He got up a lot quicker than I did, because he was a stronger bloke, and his forehead hit the side of my head just above my ear. And the referee came over to me. The referee asked me questions. Where are you? What's the score? What day is it? I answered everything correctly. I tried to stand up and play after the magic sponge, and I was stumbling around the pitch in a daze. I was concussed, but I was fully conscious. I have vivid memories of just being shouted at to get the ball, to move properly. And then I just collapsed. And the management back in the time decided to take me off then, and they installed me in the dugout, and I started to fall asleep, and the guy who was meant to be babysitting me wanted me to fall asleep, because normally I'd be a chatty guy and talking about the match, but he was delighted to not have me in his ear. And then a few minutes later, he noticed blood coming from my ear, so he screamed at the manager. The bus driver grabbed me in his arms and started running with me across the pitch. Now, I don't know whether this is a dream or whatever, but I just had visions of when he was carrying me aloft. It was like I'd scored the winning goal in the World Cup final for Ireland the following summer. And obviously, he was screaming at me. I presume the screams were celebrations. And then he got me to the bus and the screaming continued, but he was screaming the whole time to stay awake, don't fall asleep, stay awake. And because the fog was so terribly bad, the drive to the hospital. It would normally be a 10-minute drive. It was a 40-minute drive that day. He couldn't pass anything with the oncoming traffic because the fog was so bad. And at this stage, I think the fog had entered into my head. And I was dreaming, terrible dreams, I suppose. So we got to the local hospital. I was talking coherently after getting violently sick on the way in. And then I started to fall asleep, and they decided to transfer me to the brain injury hospital in Dublin. So the nurse who I was in touch with there recently, she says I was fine. I was chatty for a lot of the way, but towards the, just as we were arriving into Dublin, I deteriorated badly. And as soon as we arrived at the hospital, I rested. There was a team around me to resuscitate me, bring me in. CT scan revealed a large hematoma or blood clot, which had to be removed. And I met the surgeon a couple of years ago. He said it was an easy operation, but it was a vital operation, and time was not my best friend that day.
We have heard two very powerful testimonies underlining the seriousness of head collisions on the pitch, but experts are united in their belief that football is not treating this problem anywhere close to as well as the game should. And worryingly, it's showing no signs of immediately implementing easy yet significant changes.
Hello, my name is Peter McCabe. I'm the chief executive of Headway, the Brain Injury Association. Headway is a charity that helps survivors of a brain injury and their families. It's been our view for some time that football doesn't take the issue of concussion with sufficient seriousness. And over the years, we have raised issues with the football authorities. And we've been frustrated, I think, because there seems to be a lack of action. And it's very clear to us that football is a wonderful sport. It keeps people fit and healthy, but there is also the potential for injuries. And it seems very important that the football authorities should recognise the dangers to players.
Peter, the current protocol has club doctors and physiotherapists having to make assessments on the field of play in 3 minutes. How do you feel about that?
That to us is not long enough because it's often the case that the effects are not immediately apparent. And of course, the difficulty with a head injury is that your skull is not made of glass and you can't see what's going on inside. And we feel that there's kind of real pressure to make that assessment quickly on the field of play. And there is a reluctance on the part of players to withdraw from the game because they feel that they will be perhaps letting their teammates down and that their team will be disadvantaged. It's far better, we think, to have concussion substitutes as they do in other sports, rugby union in particular, where if somebody's got a suspected brain injury, they're removed from the pitch and an assessment can be take place in an environment where there is no hurry, no pressure, there is no disadvantage to the team that they are representing because they can bring on a concussion substitute who can play either for the duration of their assessment if they're pronounced fit to return or can continue to play because they've been deemed unfit to continue with the game. That to me is just a really common sense approach to this issue, and I cannot understand why the football authorities have not introduced this already. They are behind other sports.
Research has pointed to the potential of horrid long-term effects for players. So is Dr. Willie Stewart surprised by the game's lack of urgency and proper protocols to diminish these dangers?
Yeah, it's hugely frustrating, but sadly it's one that's repeated in every sport. It seems it's like Groundhog Day. So, you know, boxing recognized the problem with head injuries years ago and made changes to the game, and that's fine. It's a different kind of sport. But in terms of team contact sports, American football experienced these issues. It had a hard and painful route towards change, which in the early part of last decade brought around rule changes, and they've continued to be revised and reviewed over that decade. Following shortly after that, rugby saw what was coming and decided to try and make changes and adapt, and took a long and slow process to make changes and adapt, but has got to a place where it's now, it's far from perfect, but it's an awful lot better than it had been. But it seems like each sport doesn't learn the lessons of the sport before. So, you know, by now, you know, we would think global sport would understand what the problem is and how to deal with it, you know, whatever sport you're playing. But it seems like each sport wants to pick up the ball and start running with it in their own way, as if the game has never started before. So here we have football, you know, approaching this issue with head injuries in sport as if no other sport had dealt with this before, and they were starting from a blank piece of paper. Far from it. You know, look back, what's happened in rugby? Rugby tried, a very brief assessment on field, didn't work. Tried a slightly longer assessment, taking the player off the field, it didn't work either. Eventually has come to a position where you need to take the player off, replace them with somebody temporarily, spend 10 minutes at least doing what they call a multimodality assessment, where you test all sorts of brain function in the player, review the video evidence, chat to people who, you know, were witnesses on the sideline, get some idea from the other players what's going on, and then make a decision. And all of that contributes to the decision process. Football has started from scratch with this idea that somehow, you know, putting another substitute on the bench will make head injury management better. The only way that makes it better is if at this moment in time there's a rule in football that says if you have a player with a brain injury, they're not allowed to leave the park. And that's of course not the position. The problem is recognizing them. So I have no idea why football believes it has to reinvent the wheel on this. It's just hugely frustrating, and I think probably damaging to players, because, you know, best evidence on how to manage it is already established. Why is football not taking that on board?
This question stirs so much frustration and hurt for Ryan. He cannot understand why an action that could be fatal feels like it is being shrugged off.
It makes me angry. It makes me upset. So many different emotions, because I've spoke to quite a few people over the last couple of years. And firstly, I would like to combat the actual type of challenge, the perception of this type of challenge. Just because I find it very hard to believe that. So if we actually break it down and say, so the brain, the head is the most vulnerable part of the body, yet if you look at the laws of the game, the tackle from behind with excessive force that's late, that would all tick towards something that was dangerous play. Yet the perception of this type of challenge is always just brushed aside that, oh, it was a 50-50, oh, it's okay. So the actual perception of the challenge in the first place gets to me, because if you look at the laws of the game, no, it's these type of challenges that they're very, very dangerous. And you more often than not get them in the penalty box, because people will put their head, I mean, the age old saying, he puts his head where it hurts, and this bravery, which I'm all for, but if you're willing to put your head somewhere that is going to hurt someone else, that isn't necessarily bravery. For me, that's quite reckless. It's dangerous, and that's what I worry about. Now, I was on the receiving end of something where it was from over my shoulder. I couldn't see, so I was out of control of the situation, and I got this impact where I couldn't do anything about it. And now I've spoke to people, I've raised my concerns, and I've seen a very similar challenge. And the thing that gets to me probably most is that if these challenges were on the floor or with the foot, with this sort of speed and actually not making contact with the ball, then the perception is completely different. And I just find it very hard to understand why, because it can be fatal. Now, I was so, so lucky to stay alive. Like, it was very touch and go. I almost lost my life. And then I knew it would happen again because nothing's really changed in terms of perception of this type of challenge. And it has happened again. Thankfully, Rail, the medicals have come back and said that he's okay. He's going to make a recovery in his own time, which is excellent. So now for me, it's the time to make change. In many ways, the protocol of concussion is not correct. I mean, how David Luiz was able to carry on the football pitch for me is just shocking. It really is just, I just can't understand. I mean, the protocol obviously isn't right. I look at other sports like rugby, which is one of the most robust, the most physical, the most manly sports you can possibly get. You've got guys that are like 20 stone that are built like solid, and they're okay, they're fine, they accept going off the pitch, going into a room and getting an independent test to see if they're okay. So I don't understand why football is so against it.
This sentiment is mirrored by Phil Quinlan.
It saddens me, but I think it angers me even more because rugby has moved on a level. Cricket, as you're saying, has moved on a level. The other sports have moved on a level. But soccer, it just seems to remain where it is, and we're okay, Joe. I'd hate to think that one day it'll all change when a player who's concussed is severely injured and disabled like myself, or it has to die for it to change. Like if I was to meet every manager of a football team and all the suits at the highest levels who can change the rules, I'd be able to, just by looking at me, I'm a prime example of how concussion should be treated seriously.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Join us for a very Clash of the Titles Christmas, because we're doing what every family does at this time of year. Arguing about which film is better. We've proof this pod is good for your elf, as Elf takes on Santa Claus the Movie.
With Santa Claus the Movie, for years, I couldn't walk past a slice of ham without reaching for it like a grubby
street urchin.
Yeah, swear to God.
We're doing that festive thing of overindulging in sweet stuff. It's The Holiday versus Love Actually.
I've never seen women apologise so much for being women as in The Holiday.
And yes, they are Christmas movies. We've got Die Hard versus Lethal Weapon.
I'm so bored of that question, so let's flip it. Is Christmas a Die Hard movie?
That's Clash of the Titles this December. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Clash of the Titles is a Stakhanov production.
Merry Christmas!
The International Football Association board have cleared trials of an additional permanent concussion substitute, but this would not be helpful in situations like the one with David Luiz. Temporary subs, as used in other sport and easily introduced, is a much more helpful tool. Ryan agrees.
I think for me, this is the initial solution. We see it happen in rugby. And it's very important that when they are being tested, like you say, it's not in the environment where there is pressures, because the instinct of many men is to try and cheat the concussion test. I'm okay, and ignore the symptoms. Then you have the incentive of the doctor, who more often than not, his boss is the manager. Now, if your team has made 3 substitutions and you're 1-0 up and you're in a relegation battle and it's 20 minutes to go, the club are doing everything, and the staff, they're doing everything to get that player back on the football pitch. We've seen it happen before, and we will see it happen again. We will. And the worry and the problem is that David Luiz took a massive clash to his head. Now, you can't really measure what's going on in that brain. Now, David Luiz was willing to go back on the pitch and was allowed to go back on the pitch and head balls and put himself in danger, because if he copped another elbow in that situation, in that moment, then that's very dangerous, very, very dangerous. For me, I think, I've mentioned it before, I feel they need to be taken away into a private room and get an independent test from someone that isn't associated to the football club. So there's no incentive. The only priority is the care for that individual, the care for that player. And then I think you can accept it a bit more. As a football club, you can accept it. So he's gone off, he's out of our hands. If he's okay to come on, excellent. If he's not okay, then he's obviously got something going on. And the player's safety has to be the priority in these moments, whereas the current protocol, 2 or 3 minutes on the side of the pitch when you've potentially got 60,000 fans screaming at you and the referee wanting to restart the game and the pressure of the manager, and you can feel that energy. I think it's easy to ignore a little symptom or not get to the bottom or be as thorough as we can be.
Peter McCabe from Headway is fully behind this and offers a reminder of a previously unkept promise.
This goes back many years. I mean, back in 2014, there was a promise that there would be a tunnel doctor introduced. And this was following a number of incidents that had taken place both at international football level and within the Premier League in the UK, and on one occasion,
Hugo Lloris, who is the goalkeeper for Tottenham, was clearly concussed, and the physio went out onto the pitch to treat him. And when he came round, he flat out refused to leave, and was kind of quite adamant that he wasn't going to go. And both the physio and the manager of the team seemed to be overruled in that moment by somebody who was in no fit state to make that sensible decision, having just been knocked unconscious. And that was the time at which there was this promise that there would be an independent doctor in the tunnel who would be given the role of making that assessment without, free of the pressures that might exist from somebody who was an employee of the club. And I think that too, it was a very sensible suggestion, and one that could prevent serious damage to the health of players. And I can't understand why, the football authorities haven't moved and are still dragging their feet.
Is football not listening? Dr. Willie Stewart believes the issue is that the game is choosing to accept the wrong voices.
In terms of evidence of link to degenerative brain disease, in terms of pathology of dementia linked to head injury, the data in football are probably stronger than they are in any other sport. So in fact, this problem is bigger in football than it is in rugby, than it is in American football, possibly than it even is in boxing. Harrison Martland, the pathologist who first described the punch drunk syndrome, the syndrome of boxers, was working in New York. I think if he was working in Newcastle in 1928, he would have described not punch drunk syndrome of boxers, but the heading drunk syndrome of footballers. And a century later, we wouldn't be looking at the sport of football that it is now. So football, I think, has got the biggest global problem, and yet is making the least progress in this. And you say they have their fingers in their ears. Unfortunately, they don't. They possibly have their finger in their ear to the researchers who are independent of the sport and who have spent most time studying brain injury and understanding what's going on and are across the literature across all sports. So they've got the finger in the ear that we might be talking into. But the other ear is wide open and listening to the so-called experts in concussion who work within sport largely, and who tell them that the definitive evidence of a link between head injury and dementia is not there. Well, that's nonsense. Who tell them that there's a requirement for studies to prove, for instance, heading is a problem, and that those studies will involve longitudinal follow up of players from modern day era through to retirement. Well, of course, that's nonsense too. So I think what they're doing is perhaps listening to the wrong people, because the wrong people are giving them reassurance that nothing much needs to change. Don't worry about this. It's not a big problem. As opposed to listening to people who are outside of the sport, and whose affiliation is to brains, not to sport. I'm interested in trying to understand what happens to brains and solve the problems with brains. I'm not really too worried about what happens to sport or within sport. I would desperately keen that sport continues, of course, because, as well as showing the dementia problem in footballers, we also showed cardiovascular disease was much lower, cancer was lower, mental health was better in former footballers. So there's a great benefit, but there's this horrible problem with dementia.
Since the Jimenez-Luis collision, a lot has been written or spoken from professionals about this being part of the game, that risk will be involved. But Ryan believes this comes from a lack of understanding of the extent that your life and that of your family can be affected.
Maybe this is an education thing. Maybe these people need to be educated, because obviously I've read a lot of stuff and I understand quite a lot regarding the brain now. And I've not even touched the edges. There's so much detail you can go into. The experts say that it's dangerous. They say we need to change. Now, why aren't we listening? This whole culture of, oh, he's all right, get on with it. For me, that's that's one in ignorance, that's maybe a bit of naivety. And then also it's a lack of knowledge, because if you've got a family, if you've got children, if you don't know the potential damage that you could cause yourself by going on and heading balls while you're concussed, then maybe it's just a lack of education. And maybe if you know the risks, the damage it can do, not just short term, but longer term as well, then maybe everyone will view it in a different way. Now the research behind so many things like dementia and the links with head in at certain times, you can't really ignore it. It's gained a bit of momentum. There's a lot more come of it. There's more people studying it, and there's more answers. So for me, it's almost at the point, okay, so what's football's excuse to ignore it? What are the reasons? Because I can't really find any. I really can't find any reasons to just ignore it and carry on with this protocol that we have in place that clearly isn't right. Why aren't we willing to change? Why isn't football willing to accept that the brain is very vulnerable and we need to do all we can to protect our players? Now, not only short term, but long term as well. That has to be the main priority. I'm not saying that we take heading out of the game, because it's such a huge part, and it's an art to be able to head the ball in a correct way, and it's part of our game. But having said that, the treatment and the protocol in place, it really isn't right. And the more you speak about it, the more information you get, you just almost scratch your head, like, why are these people in charge ignoring it? Why? I just don't understand. I really, all the money, the back end that football has as a business, as an industry, and why aren't we putting our players first in these situations? I really don't know the answer to that. It's frustrating, but going forward, I just really hope that they take notice, they stand up, they realise that it isn't correct how it's happening at this moment, because people are obviously going back onto the pitch when they shouldn't be and putting themselves in danger. So hopefully in the short term, this can get changed very, very quickly. We're changing rules in the game, like handball and the offside at will. That's happened so much in the last 2 or 3 years. So maybe people need to accept that this is a rule, this is a protocol that needs to be changed very, very quickly.
Next month will mark 4 years since Ryan fractured his skull. Is he optimistic that time won't tick away without us still wondering why nothing has changed with football's handling of head trauma?
I have to have faith that it will change. I knew that this day would come. I knew it. I knew it would happen again. And listen, Melissa, the chances of it happening again in the next 10 years are very, very likely, to be perfectly honest. But I do believe that a change in perception of this type of challenge might even be able to stop it happening once. And then that's enough. That's made a difference, because people are still going to challenge for the ball. And some people are still willing to put their head wherever they want. And which, okay, you get that profile of player, that identity of player. But if the perception of this type of challenge is different and there's a consequence, then maybe, just maybe, it might make people in that initial moment, that split second, think about what they're doing. Because if you're willing to, like I said, if you're willing to put your head into a position that hurts someone else, then that's dangerous. That's dangerous play. So maybe just if we can stop one of these things happening again in the next 10 years, then I'll be very happy. Short term, the protocol needs to change. I don't think there's any excuse. The actual perception of the challenge, I think that's a longer term thing, and I think that's a tougher one to change people's view on it for some reason. I think that's just, we've seen that with the actual protocol of these head injuries and players willing to go back on the football pitch concussed. So the perception of the tackle is going to be a longer process, but I don't see any reason why in the next week, in the next 10 days, this protocol shouldn't change. I'm shocked it hasn't happened already, because for me it's a pretty simple solution. I really think that. But I think the more we talk about it, the more noise there is, then surely the people in control of these situations have no choice but to introduce a new protocol.
Dr. Willie Stewart has led the way in trying to force this. Does he think the game will move with the times, tighten up their protocols, and put this matter at the forefront of its thinking?
I mean, unfortunately, the way this disease, the way this association presents, it's 30 to 40 years after exposure. So we're seeing, you know, 1966 World Cup teams and thereafter now coming forward with big problems. So, you know, we're going to keep talking about footballers with dementia. We're going to keep talking about, you know, high profile teams, you know, the you know, FA Cup winning team of a certain era, the Invincibles of a certain era. You know, we're going to keep talking about these teams for the next 30 or 40 years at least. So this isn't going to go away. This is just going to build up more and more momentum. And I think football has two options, really. One is continue to listen to the wrong people and continue to try to resist change because of the fear that maybe change would mean there's something wrong with the game and might turn people off. If they go down that line, what will happen is they will turn people off, because the continued stories of problems, the continued research which is going to build on this to you know, present more and more data of the risk of genital brain disease and probably the problems in football, that's going to continue to build up. You know, parents are going to vote with their feet when their kids are picking up sport, and they're going to be worried about whether this sport of football is looking after their kids properly, and whether they might be threatening the future of their kids' education and career by encouraging them to play football. That's what happened to American football. American football youth level participation was decimated because American football resisted change. So you know, that's one route. The other route is football says, right, we have this problem, and as a global industry, we care about those people who participate in it, and we're going to make changes. We're going to have to just take this and make changes, and these are the changes we'll make: temporary substitutions, restriction on heading as much as possible, and look at whether the game can be modified to make heading safer. So, you know, if it does that, then I think people will say this is a sport that actually does care about its participants' brains, that does look after players and future players, and you know, people will continue to engage with it because the risk, as I say, of doing nothing is people think there's potential damage here. I don't want to get involved. You know, I'll take my kids out to track and field, or, you know, rugby. You know, because rugby, believe it or not, looks after the players better. So maybe that's where I'll go.
Thanks to our guests for sharing their passion, their research, their personal experiences and feelings on an extremely serious matter. I hope you have a much better understanding of the dangers of head trauma in football. More than that, though, my great hope is that the game wakes up and implements changes that could save lives. If in doubt, sit them out. Between the Lines is a Stakhanov production, written and narrated by me, Melissa Reddy. Our producer is Charlie Morgan. Our assistant producer is Natalie Wilson. The executive producers are John Teague and Luke Aaron Moore. Sound design and mixing is by Tom Wally. All music comes courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Thanks for listening. Tune in next time.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.